Welcome to the HIV Australia podcast, a discussion about the community-led response to HIV. In November 2018, the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations hosted a discussion about how bipartisanship has underpinned the Australian response. You're listening to Dr. Neil Blewett, Health Minister in 1983, and his opposition counterpart, Dr. Peter Bohm.
First of all, I just want to start with you, Neil. Just paint a picture for us. Tell us about the moment you first heard about HIV.
Well, I can give a definite date to it, and that was the 12th of March, 1983. I'd read in American magazines about a odd disease which was affecting the gay community or groups of gays in the United States, but it was just something that you read about, but you never followed up. But on March the 12th, on March the 12th, this is the day after we were sworn in, about 20 of the senior public servants in the health department came across to an office in Parliament House, one of the big meeting rooms in Parliament House. I sat at one end of the table with all these bureaucrats around me. They brought in two great volumes of papers. They were all out to show how much they knew about Labor policy. When I talked about Medicare, they had all the things there. I talked about what we wanted to do with the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. Yes, they jumped up with Labor policies. You know, very impressive performance. And this went on all the morning. We got through the first volume. And then in the afternoon, in the second volume, I think item 32 on their agenda was a thing called GRID, as Peter said, gay-related immune deficiency. And I said, well, what's this? And they said, oh, and then they explained that the Disease Control Center in Atlanta had identified a disease which affected groups of gays in the United States. They were not sure what it was. There are arguments it might be viral. There are other arguments that it was very much the ambience in which gay people live, some environmental factor produced it, or it might have been a bacterium. But my advisors did not think on the whole, the medical people in that gathering, did not on the whole think it was a virus, but they didn't want to rule that out. And that was when I first heard of, well, it was first brought to my attention, I couldn't escape it, that we had this problem. They told me there were no cases in Australia. They, of course, were wrong. But that was because the state and Commonwealth health departments didn't connect very well. And in fact, the publicity for the first case in Australia, the public medical statement about it, wasn't until March, I think, 1983. But as yet, the Commonwealth health department had not been told that there was one case already in Australia.
And Peter, you of course would have been learning about this without the benefit of the Commonwealth Department of Health at the time. I mean, what was your first understanding of HIV?
Okay, I'd been Minister for Health some time before, but my medical reading told me there was this disease and that it was getting worse. And so I went through that period in 1983 was very painful, by the way,
A period of deprivation.
When you lose government. But during 1984 and 1985, it was centre stage. It was, you know, there were people going to three funerals a week. Just, that's incredible. Three funerals of friends every week. And so we knew all about it in probably in 1984-85.
Of course, bipartisanship doesn't happen overnight. When was the first time you discussed it with each other?
Well, in many ways, the initiative was taken by your shadow minister for health, James Porter. And it resulted after I went to the United States in January 1984. The overseas journey had been set up in response to Bob Hawke's pledge in the 1984 election that he'd have a drug summit. And so I was sent round to the United States, Great Britain, Shanghai for some reason, Singapore, to look at their drug policies. But of course, by early 1985, we'd had the crisis in Australia. AIDS had become the dominant medical topic in the newspapers by the end of 1984, when the Queensland Babies incident brought it, and it never got out of the headlines, I think, for the next 3 years. Where was I? Right. I went to America, and I learned three things there. One, I saw the different approaches of New York, which was a medical model, authority model. I saw San Francisco, which was a much more cooperative model, and so I contrasted those. The second thing I was struck by was that the president had never mentioned the word AIDS, even though America by that time had a large number of cases, but Reagan refused to mention the word. And the third thing I learned in America was how bitter a partisan debate was over AIDS, that the Democrat Party had one position, the Republican Party had another position. So I came back determined that, if possible, that shouldn't happen here. We didn't want it to become that kind of partisan issue that it was in the United States. And James Porter talked to me about possibilities of cooperation, because they had a lot of problems in there, more problems in their party than I think in mine, and wanted to see if we could get a cooperative work. And out of that came this parliamentary liaison committee, consisting of members from both parties, plus, interesting enough, I think it was Peter's suggestion, that Harradine, the moral crusader from Tasmania, who caused lots of problems whenever these issues, other sorts of related issues came up, put him on the committee and get him briefed and involved, which was a first-class tactic. Also, of course, the committee was dominated, in a sense, by the Liberals, because they had all these intelligent people with no jobs. So the very able representatives on the Liberal side, we had good people too, but I just say that the balance was in that direction.
Well, let's hear about that from Peter. I mean, having the debate within the Liberal Party, which likes to pride itself on being a broad church, what was that like in the early days? What was discussion
like? In 1984, it really was a broad church. I come from the political centre, and it was easy for me to be a member of the Liberal Party. When John Howard became Prime Minister in 1996, and he announced he was the most conservative leader the Liberal Party had ever had, I resigned. Because nothing wrong with what he said, but it wasn't for me. In 1984, however, it was very broad. That means we had some people. Just let me digress. Do you remember the film Rampant, which featured Bill Bowtell extensively? And one of the things he said that was really important was we had a choice. We could adopt that punitive model, or we could adopt a cooperative model. And we had people in our party who wanted to adopt the punitive model. We had to convince them that they were wrong. Luckily, the Hawke government introduced a whole lot of contentious legislation. So it was possible then to go to the shadow cabinet and say, we've got lots of things to fight on. We can fight on this, this, and this, this, and this. On this matter, let it go over our shoulder. And had the Hawke government not done that, we wouldn't have carried the day.
Just on that, Peter, I've heard around the traps that you did have a little more difficulty convincing people like Wilson Tuckey of the merits of the
Wilson Tuckey was also known as Iron Bar Tuckey, and the reason was he'd hit someone with an iron bar. So he was very much a backwoodsman, and with very, very primitive views. And he said to me in Hobart, people go out and catch AIDS. So I didn't talk to him about people with haemophilia. I didn't talk to him about babies that are born by vertical transmission with HIV. I didn't talk about any of that. But we had a stand-up fight. And Wilson Tuckey and I never got on well. His wife, by the way, was a very nice person. It just beats me how she ever put up with him. But he represented that punitive view that we wanted to overcome.
And at that stage, he was Shadow Minister for Health.
He was. He had to be kept right out of it.
And indeed, following that conference at Hobart, where he performed, as Peter has pointed out, he also attacked one of the leading AIDS medical men, Professor Dwyer, and told him publicly, out loud, he didn't know what he was talking about. And about 2 months later, he disappeared as Shadow Health Minister. I attribute that to actions within your party.
But one thing that hasn't come out is that one night out of the blue, when I was working at my desk, as one does, reading letters and goodness knows what, I got a phone call saying, come round for a cup of tea. And in parliamentary code, that means I've got something important to talk to you about. And so I went round to Neil Blewett's office. That's how it all started. That cup of tea. Mm-hmm. Bill Bartel was there. He'll remember all about that meeting.
He probably orchestrated it.
I'm sure it was a cup of tea. Nothing else.
Neil, you've already alluded to people like Brian Harradine, who I think was in the Labor Party at the time.
No, we'd removed him.
Oh, you'd removed him, right.
He was then the a Democratic Labor Party. Or he might have even been an independent by then, but he was here.
But it can't have all been smooth sailing within the Labor Party either, given some of the moral contours of the Labor Party. What sort of challenges did you have?
Very little, surprisingly. There was a Catholic element in the party who were, I know, unhappy rather about my policies, and who I know went to the Prime Minister and others. You have to do something about this Blewett person. But Hawke was very good in that in their specific policy areas, he allowed ministers a pretty free hand, provided they didn't get into real trouble. And of course, when they wanted money, they have come back to the cabinet. But other than that, he trusted his ministers, and you'd have to have a very powerful case indeed to get him to intervene against what you were doing. Now, again, I was not in cabinet in those days. I was in exile in the outer ministry. And I know that there were discussions in cabinet at times about my policy, because it got reported back to me, cabinet's leaked like that. There was never any serious challenge to the policies from within the Labour Party. Nor, interestingly enough, was, for instance, I cannot remember a discussion about AIDS policy in the cabinet the only times in fact there were discussions about AIDS was when you had to come to the cabinet for money, but the actual policy, what you were doing, the sort of policies you were pursuing were not, in to my memory, ever debated in cabinet. The only other issue which didn't go to cabinet had to go to the Prime Minister, and that was the Grim Reaper advertisement. Given the problems with that advertisement and the fact that it was coming on the eve of an election, we thought it best to show it to Hawke before it was released to the public.
Just on that issue of money, Paul Keating once famously said to never stand in the way of a premier in a bag of money. But of course, Joe Bjelke-Petersen rejected Commonwealth funding for HIV, didn't he?
Yes, and I pointed out to Paul that his theory about these state premiers in that particular case was wrong. What happened was that when we made the commitment to policies after the 1984 summits and into the 1985 budget, we provided AIDS money to the states, but one of the conditions was that a certain percentage of that money had to be paid into their AIDS organizations. They were committed to that. They had to do that. Otherwise, they didn't get the money. All the states who were perfectly happy to take Commonwealth money, one of the reasons I think they encouraged the Commonwealth to play a leading role in AIDS was it meant that they were getting money for handling the disease. Queensland refused. The only time in my dealings with Bjelke Petersen that he ever refused Commonwealth money, on the grounds that homosexuality was illegal in Queensland and therefore he couldn't give it to illegal people. So we had to find some way of channeling that amount of money to the AIDS organisation in Queensland, and we found excellent money laundresses in the Little Sisters of Mercy. they'd been very much involved in supportive work for people suffering from AIDS, so they were already involved in the issue, and they were willing to, so we paid the money to them, and they paid it on to the AIDS organisations. And some 10 years ago, I ran into an old nun, I couldn't remember her face, and she said to me, "I'm your money laundress."
This whole approach of harm minimisation and evidence-based policy, this was relatively new, of course, at the time. I'm just want to probe this a little, Neil. The advice that you were getting, given how innovative this was, how could you be sure it was going to work and have confidence in these new policy settings that, in many respects, I mean, on needle and syringe programs were really trailblazing policy?
Well, in a sense, we couldn't know that it was going to work. But as the doctors had no cure, I mean, in a way, AIDS deauthorized elements of the medical profession because they could not offer what was basis of their authority in society. They could not offer a cure. They could deal with the opportunistic infections resulting from the breakdown of the immune system, but they had no cure for the actual disease itself. And therefore, we had to look at other ways. We had to look at other ways of trying to prevent the spread of the disease. We couldn't use standard methods for doing this. I want to say that it came. In a way, it evolved. It wasn't some blinding light that, yes, this is the way we're going to approach it. It came in steps. Sometimes we may even have gone a bit backwards, but it evolved over the period from the time I returned from America, basically, or after the summits of late 84, then over the next 12 months, the basic outlines of the policy evolved. But it involved in steps. I mean, we had a battle, for instance, over once we got all our blood banks covered with after the blood banks were enabled to test for the AIDS virus, then came the question of, well, how are we going to compel people to be tested? Now, some of the doctors wanted all gays to be tested. Well, I said to them, but how do you recognise? I mean, how are you going to pick them out? I mean, well, let's do everybody, they said. Well, of course, the cost of the AIDS test for everyone in Australia was just so phenomenal that Keating would not have agreed to that. On the other hand, I wanted, and many of us wanted to know, the extent of the disease in the community. So we wanted to encourage testing without making it compulsory. And therefore we provided advisory services before testing, advisory services after testing, to make it as as attractive as possible for people to come forward, but to avoid the sort of authoritarian compulsion methods that have been usually used, and rightly so in many ways, for treating epidemic diseases.
Peter, were there any moments when, you know, whether it was the expansion of testing or the rollout of needle and syringe programs or explicit advertising to reach gay and bisexual men, that you felt that the bipartisanship was being stretched and it was difficult for you to argue the case within the Liberal Party?
No, because everything Neil has said is right. We actually didn't know what to do. And what was being suggested, Bill and Neil were suggesting to me, sounded reasonable. And therefore it was something that should be supported. And there's no problem supporting something from the other side of politics, or there wasn't any problem in the 1980s. And it's a pity it's not done more often.
The bipartisanship is one thing, but the media, of course, must have played a really critical role.
Yep.
We've heard a little about people like Iha Buttrose. What was the process of, I suppose, winning editorial support, or at least trying to, you know, stem the worst excesses of tabloid reporting to undertake this project?
Well, the press was extraordinarily difficult. I remember my first public statement on AIDS was in June 1983, when I reprimanded the Medical Journal of Australia for its front cover, in which it had a cover. It had a Grim Reaper on the cover then. It had the gay plague of the 80s. Really a horrendous front page for the leading medical journal in Australia. So I wrote the editor and made a public statement criticising this approach. It was playing into the hands of the media, and the editor wrote back to me and said, "Oh, Dr. Bird, I was being ironical." And 6 months later, he wrote me another letter saying, "I now realise that it's a dangerous thing, irony in politics." But that, I remember my first intervention, and it was in relation to a media story. And this went on really for the next 3 years. A constant barrage of attacks in the media, who played up the sensationalism of AIDS, who got a lot of support from elements of the medical profession who are unhappy with the government, not just on the AIDS issue, but on other issues. Important point I would make here is that nearly all the clinicians, that is nearly all of the doctors in touch and dealing with AIDS patients, were in fact supportive of what we were doing, and would come out and publicly declare that this was the right way to go. But big proportion of the medical profession, a lot of them with a considerable authority, but had no real experience of the disease, nevertheless made life very difficult for the minister.
However, you were really helped when you appointed Iha Buttrose, because that changed the dynamics immediately and dramatically.
Do you want to just unpack the Iha Buttrose story for us?
Tell Bill's story. We'd set, in the summits of late 84, we set up the AIDS Task Force, which was a entirely medical body, and it was responsible to the states because it was set up by a state conference. But Jelki Peterson made it quite clear that Queensland would not belong to this body if there were any AIDS people. So it became a purely medical body with, I think, one or two gay doctors, but nevertheless it was a purely medical body. And Bill and I decided that we needed to balance that with a body which would look at the social side of AIDS, social impact, education, that side of it. And then we had to look around to find somebody. And I think it was Bill's idea, he knew Ita, that she would be excellent media person. She would go well with the gay community. And of course she was an excellent publicist. And she was superb. The doctors would attack her, or some of the medicos would attack her, because she had no medical knowledge. And she used to fight back words, she said, and they've got no idea how properly to communicate with the public, sort of thing. Her communication skills were outstanding, and there was some tension between the two committees, which I think was on the whole creative, between the AIDS task force and the NACAIDS.
Peter, I'm interested in your perspective as much as a real doctor, as a former politician. But of course, the involvement of people most affected by HIV has been critical to the policy success that we've had in this country. What lessons do you think other conditions can draw from how HIV has mobilised its communities?
Okay. One of the commodity that was most prized in Canberra was power. And the moment clinicians would agree to have the people affected in charge and not them, they're giving up power to do so. And so you could predict in advance that they'd be against such an approach. Nevertheless, it makes sense, doesn't it? Because the people who have most to lose or most to gain are the affected people. And it worked.
Were there any moments that reinforced that for you, you know, when you first got to know people who were living with AIDS or with HIV in the 1980s?
Well, what impressed me particularly was the willingness of the gay community to do something, to do something effective. And the first thing we had to do was promote condom use before we had effective antiretroviral drugs. I remember once I went to Tonga and I met the Catholic bishop. And I said, wouldn't it be a tragedy, my lord, if in 10 years' time the only people getting infected were your flock? And he said, oh, don't worry. He said, I believe in condoms. He said, just my brothers don't. And they still don't.
Just throwing forward a little now, we seem to live in a more sort of febrile political environment today. The bipartisan consensus that you forged in the 1980s was quite extraordinary. Would it be possible now?
Well, given the state of national politics at the moment, I would have grave doubts that we could have had the kind of liaison that developed in the 80s. But also, it's not just politicians. The populist instincts of early 21st century democracy are worrying. That is, for instance, just imagine if in this country the Islamic community caught a transmissible disease, what sort of demands the populace would make. And I think politicians might well surrender to them. Whereas in the 1980s, we were able to resist, though it was a struggle, because I think a lot of the media suggested and surveys suggested that the populace wanted a much tougher policy towards gays and HIV than we were pursuing. So I imagine now that populist instinct in our societies is much more dangerous.
And there were people around the world doing quite amazing things. That photo of Princess Di with her arm around someone with AIDS, that went viral around the world. And it told people in one instant that a lot of their fears were unfounded. And that did more good.
Well, just on that, Peter, it is very easy to be nostalgic. I mean, what are some of the other positive things that you've noticed over the last three and a half decades?
Well, I agree with Neil that, I mean, we're both old men, and so we would have a negative view of the people who followed on. but nevertheless, I think that bipartisan policy is less likely today. I think they're playing far more adversarial politics than we did. And I think that's a pity, because what matters is solving problems. My dad used to say, it doesn't matter if you can solve the problem, it doesn't matter who gets the credit. And he was right.
Final reflection from both of you. What do you hold up, I suppose, as the most profound achievement of the year that we've been discussing?
I would say the achievement reflected in the white paper of 1988, which reflected the endorsement of really the parliament, the leadership, most of the medical profession, an endorsement of the policies that we pursued. The thing that I find encouraging is that those policies have been pursued in relation to AIDS in a very different climate and very different scientific contribution now being made to AIDS. So I think it was that lasting contribution which we established in those difficult years of the middle 80s.
Okay, and I think the thing that I remember most is the policy itself. The idea that the affected people can fix the problem rather than we doctors coming from Mount Olympus can fix it was something quite new to me and something that really worked.